This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is the daughter of an African leader who was executed in 1975. In her new memoir, Aminata Forna investigates what happened to her father and what it reveals about the country she is from, Sierra Leone. The book is called The Devil That Danced on the Water. Her father, Dr. Mohamed Forna, studied medicine in Scotland, where he met his first wife, a white Scottish woman. With his wife, he returned to Sierra Leone, where Aminata was born. Dr. Forna practiced medicine and then became one of the new generation of political leaders in the 60s when Sierra Leone was a fledgling democracy breaking away from British colonial rule. After becoming Minister of Finance, he became an opponent of the increasingly authoritarian government, was removed from office, and later accused of conspiracy. In 1975, he was hanged with seven others. After one of his imprisonments, Aminata, her siblings, and her stepmother, her father had remarried, fled the country. She has since lived in England. She has vivid memories of her father's 1974 arrest when she was 10.
The night my father was arrested, I remember quite clearly, I always have remembered quite clearly, we were at home and I was alone in the sitting room. I was laying out a game that we were going to play that evening. My father was in the bedroom with my mother. The house had been quite quiet that day, although I came to remember that part later. I looked up from what I was doing, laying out some bingo cards, and I saw two men standing on our balcony. I went out and asked them what they wanted, and they told me they were here to speak to the doctor. And I went to the bedroom door to fetch my father. He came out directly and spoke to the men, and then he turned to me and said that he had to go with these men now, and asked me to fetch him a couple of toothpicks from the sideboard. He used to have a habit of chewing toothpicks. And I did that. And then the very last thing he said was, tell Mum I'll be back later. So that actually was the last but one time I saw him. The next time I saw him, he was in handcuffs and he'd already been condemned to death. But I was the last person to see him go.
What was he arrested for?
He was arrested and later charged with treason, and his arrest followed an attack on, or an alleged attack, on the house of the vice president. Somebody had thrown dynamite at it, and my father was accused of being part of a plot to overthrow the government.
You were 11 at the time your father was hanged. You were living in Sierra Leone, but you were being educated in England, so you were spending a lot of time away from home, and you were in England on the day he was executed. Did you understand what was happening? What were you told?
I wasn't told very much. I mean, in that era, in the 70s, and also particularly in that culture, it was not really felt that you told children very much. I think people felt that they were protecting children, protecting us in this particular instance, by not telling us anything. So I didn't, had only a vague idea. What it did to me, not being told, was that it created this enormous curiosity. And my brother and sister and I used to, we used to snoop and rifle and try to get as much information as we could. I knew that he was in prison. I knew that he was being charged for treason. I didn't have any understanding at that age that treason was a capital offence. And when he died, I was told, in fact, that he died of an illness. He died in prison of an illness.
Let's back up a little bit. Your father was a doctor. He was trained in Scotland. He went to medical school in Aberdeen. He had returned to Sierra Leone after school, set up a clinic there. How and why did he get involved with politics?
My father was always political, with a small p. He was always very active. He always had a very strong sense of the injustices that he saw around him. And even when he was at school, he was already writing letters about constitutional changes and posting them off to newspapers and to the government. He became a doctor because he thought that he might rectify that, but also because those were the sorts of scholarships that were being offered. But it fitted with his vision. He went back to Sierra Leone at a time when the incumbent government were moving the country towards a one-party state, and this was happening all over Africa. And the opposition, the APC, were looking for young men, particularly Western educated young men, because they needed these people to gain some kind of credibility among certain populations in the country, the middle class population, the city-based population, and also Western governments and agencies. My father resisted in the first instance, but gradually, as he, I think, became overwhelmed by the level of poverty and mismanagement in the country, he gradually allowed himself to be wooed into the party, and he agreed to stand as an MP.
So he was trying to keep a two-party system and to stop a kind of one-party dictatorship.
Yeah, I mean, the APC was fighting the election. His party was fighting the election on that very ticket, that they would stop a one-party state coming into Sierra Leone, as it had in Ghana, in Kenya, you know, in so many other countries in Africa.
When did you decide that you wanted to find out the real story behind your father's trial and execution?
Well, I can't even remember that, because it was a lifetime ago. Well, I always knew I didn't know enough about it. My stepmother had always tried to protect me by not telling me very much. In fact, later on, when I did decide to write the book and when I talked to her about it, she said that actually one of the reasons she'd been like that was because she was on the verge of falling apart herself, and the only way that she could protect us and herself was by really trying to move on and not revisit it. But it seemed to us, that us the children, this incredible silence surrounded everything about my father. And yet there was this anomaly. He had been hanged as a traitor. I knew that by then. And yet when I visited Sierra Leone, when I walked down the street among the ordinary people, he was treated as a hero. People came up and embraced me. You know, market people would give me a few mangoes or bananas and not ask me to pay for them. Taxi drivers would let me off my taxi fare. So those were the two things that were not reconciled. Why was he hanged as a traitor and yet treated, his memory treated in that way? So gradually I wanted more and more of these questions resolved. And the other major thing was that I knew gradually, by a process, I suppose, of osmosis, eavesdropping and reading documents I shouldn't have, I knew that on the fateful night where he was supposed to be attacking or leading an attack on the vice president's house, I knew, because I remembered it vividly, that he had been at home, because something very important had happened that night.
What happened?
A man was brought to our house with a wounded hand. And my father had dressed his hand, and I had helped my father to bandage the man's hand. And that turned out to be something that was absolutely pivotal in his trial.
Was that brought up in the trial? Did the man who was wounded testify on behalf of your father?
The man that was wounded, I discovered later, when I came to research my father's trial, had died before the trial. Curiously, he didn't play a very important part in the trial, although he was definitely linked with whatever events had occurred at the vice president's house. He was an armed military man, a soldier. He was involved in something, and he'd been hurt handling, apparently, a grenade.
So was the prosecutor just trying to overlook as much as possible the fact that your father had treated this man, because that would be an alibi and the prosecutor didn't want him to have one?
That's correct. The fact my father had treated the man proved that he was somewhere else on the night that this attack had happened. And what they were trying to do was prove that my father had been part of the attack. Later on, I traced the four witnesses who had given evidence against my father and placed him at the site of the alleged attack, or of the attack, whoever carried it out. And all four of those men admitted that they had been paid to say that they'd seen him there.
How much did they get in return for handing over your father?
In fact, they'd been promised money, and the first one that I interviewed spent some time complaining to me that he'd never received the money that he had been promised. They were promised jobs, they were promised scholarships to universities in the West, and they were promised cash, and they didn't see very much of that, and two of them still felt extremely aggrieved that they had never received the money that they had been promised. They didn't seem to feel in any way, they didn't seem to feel any remorse at all for what they'd done. They didn't even seem to appreciate they were sitting opposite the person that they had helped to kill's daughter. They just, even 25 years later, cared only about the money.
So did you get angry with them sitting across from them getting these stories, or did you just be neutral so you could get more information?
Yeah, I did the latter. I mean, one of the reasons it took me a while to write the book, I mean, although, you know, I was in my mid-30s when I wrote it, it didn't take me a huge amount of time to get on with it. But I do remember, I mean, I wanted to write this for a very long time. And in my mid-20s, I felt to myself, I'm not mature enough to do this. I didn't have the emotional maturity. And I also really knew that I needed to be a much, much better journalist to approach a story that involved me so closely and that was such a complicated story. So by the time that I was sitting opposite the men who had given evidence, false testimony against my father, I had accomplished a fair amount of self-control and I didn't display it. And I could see, you know, in Sierra Leone, I'm mixed race. People considered me to be white or they see me as European. So I could see that the reality of who I was wasn't really set, you know, sitting with this man. And also, I never, ever used to refer to my father as my father when I interviewed people. I always referred to him as Dr. Fauna. And that was part of trying to distance me from the subject matter. And it did appear to work. Neither of these two men really, really seemed to be registering the fact that they were talking to the person's daughter. And I felt that if I... You know, if I interrupted our interview and laboured that fact or alerted them to it or reminded them of it, that I would, that they wouldn't tell me so much.
You not only investigated how your father was set up at his trial, you also investigated how what he had to say. How did he carry himself at his trial? What did you learn about that?
I was immensely proud when I discovered how my father had conducted himself at his trial. There was a moment when the prosecutor, whose name was Tom Johnson, confronted my father with the testimony of another man who had, one of the other accused, who had placed my father at the scene of the attack. And what was already quite well known, and my father would certainly have guessed, was that the other people who'd been arrested alongside him had been very badly beaten, many of them tortured, and this false testimony drawn from them. This was read out in court and used against my father, and the chief prosecutor asked my father, is it true? And my father said, no, it is not true. And the chief prosecutor said, have you no conscience to say that this man who is your friend is a liar? And my father replied to him, I have a conscience and I have a heart. And what he meant by that was, or what I understood he meant by that was, that he knew that these people were giving testimony because they had been beaten, because they had been tortured, and because they had been forced to. And I think that's what he meant when he said, I have a heart.
In other words, that he was forgiving them for testifying against him.
Exactly, that he was forgiving them. He knew how the system worked there, and I think that some of the beatings took place fairly publicly. In fact, in one of the very last letters he wrote, he described hearing some of the men being beaten, and he described overhearing a conversation between two of them where one had said, if you give them Dr. Mohammed Fauna's name, they'll stop beating you.
Do you think if he had made a deal that he could have survived?
I think it's possible. I think that is possible. Shaka Stevens knew that my father was immensely popular. He knew that he was the only person who could lead a viable opposition against him. Shaka Stevens also had come to hate my father because when my father resigned, he had alerted the country and the entire international community to Shaka Stevens's corruption. He'd accused him of violence, he'd accused him of megalomania, and apparently Stevens was absolutely enraged by this. But I think it's faintly possible that Stevens might have spared him if he had had the kind of response from my father that would have made that possible. I'm not certain about it, but he might just have.
Your father had been a medical doctor. When you returned to Sierra Leone to investigate his execution, you were probably seeing lots of people who had hands or feet amputated. During the Civil War, the rebels had threatened people with amputations if they voted, because the rebels didn't want them to vote. And I'm just wondering your impressions of traveling through your country of birth and seeing people who had lost limbs in the Civil War through amputations.
It's a very shocking thing, the loss of limbs, and although it is ascribed, the action on the part of the rebels of chopping off people's hands is ascribed to being a comment on the elections, what I saw did not seem to tally with that explanation. I saw babies who had lost both arms. I remember seeing a very pretty young girl. In fact, I took her photograph, and she really wanted to be photographed with her friend. And to a Western eye, it was a really shocking picture, because there she was with both arms chopped off above the elbow, and her friend who'd lost one arm. There was no explanation for that, really. There was simply no explanation for it. And I have, when I was last back, which was actually only 3 or 4 weeks ago, I was in a position to talk to people who had been in the area where these sorts of things were happening. And there seems to be a huge amount of denial about it now. The rebels, the RUF, deny that it was anything to do with them. They say that it was the Kamajors, who were one of the militias who fought against them. They say it wasn't them, that it was the government forces. So now there's a huge amount of denial, and I can't imagine that it was anything but a drug. I mean, there's a huge amount of drug use, deliberate use on child soldiers, a kind of drug-fueled aggression towards a civilian population to do anything to subdue them.
This kind of massive, sadistic terrorist campaign.
I think so, yes.
What are your feelings about your country now? You know, the country of your birth. You loved it when you grew up there. The government had executed your father. You returned, you know, recently to find the aftermath of this campaign of terrorism.
I'm cautiously optimistic about Sierra Leone. I mean, it has taken me a long time to feel comfortable again there. I dreaded going back when I was researching the book. I always felt deeply unhappy when I was in the country, in a way that, you know, I could only ascribe to the events that had taken place there. And I remember when I was a child, I used to look forward so much to going home to Sierra Leone, and from the moment of my father's death, I could no longer bear to go to that country until I came to the point where I avoided it altogether for 10 or 15 years. Gradually, I've got more used to going back there, and I've begun to enjoy it again. And this time I went up to my father's village, in fact the village that my grandfather had founded, which is deep in the, you know, it's actually surrounded by forest, and it is the most beautiful place. And I spent a week there with my husband. We were building a school for the village. And I was just surrounded by people of such kindness and goodwill. So, you know, a kind of lot of my childhood sense has returned.
In your acknowledgments, you mentioned a couple of people who have been in slightly similar situations to you. You mentioned Gillian Slovo, whose parents were with the African, with the ANC, the African National Congress, and I believe one of her parents was executed.
Mother was murdered.
Yeah, and her parents were anti-apartheid activists. And you mentioned Ken Wiwa, whose father was a dissident in Nigeria, and he was executed. I find it really interesting that in your case and in Ken Wiwa's case, by writing about your parents' execution, you're making it less possible for people to forget this happened. In spite of the government's attempt to, like, annihilate the bodies and, you know, put them in mass graves and just kind of write them out of history and cover it up to whatever extent they could.
It was my intention, really, to bring stories like this to the public consciousness in the West. My father wasn't really anybody who had a significance outside of Sierra Leone. He was one of thousands of political prisoners imprisoned and killed across Africa. And so I used his story in a way that I felt was emblematic, that he was emblematic, we were emblematic of what had happened to Africa in the post-colonial period. And I really felt that in my position, being partly British and partly African, and having so many friends, you know, I would sit at middle-class dinner parties in London, and I would hear people talk about Africa as though it were another world, not just another continent. It's the difficulty people have in understanding what's going in going on in Africa. The sort of, not boredom, but... you know, the tiredness of the constant problems, and also the exoticisation, the alienation of Africans who we see so much on our news programmes just as heaped dead bodies somewhere, but not as individuals. And I would think, if you knew my story and you knew what had happened to somebody sitting at this table, somebody you could associate with, if you could make that connection, then you would feel quite differently about Africa. And so that was, I very deliberately attempted to do that.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
That's very kind of you. Thank you very much.
Aminata Forna's new memoir is called The Devil That Danced on the Water.